I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Pink ribbons, its high-profile corporate sponsors, and Walk for the Cure events have become synonymous with the fight against breast cancer. Products ranging from guns and gasoline to Kentucky Fried Chicken and Yoplait yogurt, along with the walks and the runs, have raised billions of dollars for research and efforts to find a cure for breast cancer. But where has all that money gone? Has philanthropy and the corporatization of breast cancer decreased breast cancer rates? Is that even the ultimate goal? In the 1940s, a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer was 1 in 22. Today, it's 1 in 8. So how are these women being helped by the billions raised? That's the question posed in the new documentary film, Pink Ribbons, Inc. This documentary highlights some of the massive fundraising runs and questions where the money goes. Who really profits from all of the pink ribbon campaigns? And when did all of this start? Ravita Din is the producer of Pink Ribbons, Inc., a breast cancer survivor herself. She says it was disheartening to be reminded that no matter what cause they align themselves with, a company's ultimate goal is profit. Hi, Ravita. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. So, you know, we've done a number of shows about breast cancer and the fact that there's so much focus on the word cause or cure, I should say, rather than prevention and cause. What I loved about your film is that you also give us a historical analysis about the first pink ribbon and also about the walks that took place in the 80s and the early 90s. So first off, why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, what really sparked your interest in this topic?
Yeah, I actually had been gone through my own treatment for breast cancer, and I was probably just coming out of sort of the final weeks in the treatment for radiation. And my sister, unfortunately, had also gone through treatment at the same time as myself, and we were both sort of perplexed a little bit that we weren't actually reading a lot about the disease and women's health, specifically as it relates to cancer, a lot. And we both have a very long history of activism, and particularly in the feminist movement. And you know, it wasn't until I came across an article written by Barbara Ehrenreich called "Welcome to Cancerland" that I had that first kind of aha moment. And I thought, of course, you know, what have I been thinking? I need to look at what feminists are writing about women's health in general and about this disease. What I loved about Barbara Ehrenreich's article was that she, you know, in her very typical cynical, wry humor, she talks about this culture that we've created, and she talked about how, you know, the involvement of corporations in the cause, if you will, in aligning themselves to the breast cancer cause, they've actually normalized breast cancer. And by normalizing it, they've completely depoliticized it. So I became very interested in that. And it actually helped me answer some of my own personal questions around why I wasn't really feeling that sympathetic to a lot of the fundraising efforts, the walks, the runs, and the way that people were coming together and mobilizing around the disease. So her article really helped me understand that better. And that actually led me to Samantha King's book that the film is based on.
And Samantha King will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. You talked about Barbara Ehrenreich. She was treated for breast cancer in 2000 and 2001. And she says she didn't research the science. She became fascinated by the breast cancer culture and the pink ribbons. And she makes an interesting point in the film. And she talks about the fact that women used to march in the streets in the 80s and the early 90s. They used to march, for example, in downtown San Francisco with the Toxics Coalition, trying to get companies to take some responsibility for chemicals in our environment and in our bodies. Can you talk just a little bit about that movement in the 80s and what the focus was back then?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the women's movement changed everything in terms of the way that women we're talking about and raising questions about our own health, the kind of research that was taking place, the fact that women needed to actually figure out how to be much more empowered and active citizens in the way that our health was being defined. What what I think was interesting about the way women were organizing, and, you know, I know in the 80s, early 90s, we had women's health collectives everywhere here in Canada that I was certainly part of, and it was about taking personal experiences and bringing them into a public platform. You know, and that could mean coming together, whether as a health collective and looking at ways to lobby government for better treatment options for women, or it could mean actually marching on the streets and trying to determine what some of the root causes were for inequity around the treatment of women's health. So, you know, we lost a lot of that, and some of it was a direct result of the significant backlash against the women's movement, as women's groups lost a lot of their funding that just simply allowed them to operate. And you saw in the early 90s, massive cuts to social programs, and this was an opportunity for corporations to start moving in and filling the gap. And what I really like about Samantha King's book is she traces some of that history and talks about Reagan and how he, you know, provided some major incentives to corporations and encouraged this whole idea of corporations becoming good citizens. Now, I don't actually think women ever stopped being active. You know, the activism continues. I just think it became much harder. And when you have corporations with a lot of money stepping in, that's where the spotlight, unfortunately, goes as well.
And that is Ravita Din. She's producer of the new documentary Pink Ribbons, which opens in the Bay Area this Friday. You can find more information about openings at yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Samantha King to the show. Samantha is associate professor in the School of... Can you help me with this one?
Sure, so, kinesiology.
Kinesiology, thank you. I'm looking at this thinking, I know how to say this, but it's not coming out. Kinesiology and Health Studies, Cultural Studies Program at Queen's University in Canada, and author of the book Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy, on which the film is based. And thank you for joining us, Samantha.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. We were just talking about the... just what's in the film and the fact that Ravita does such a great job of looking at the history behind the breast cancer movement. And what I love about your contribution to the film is that you really talk about what happened when Ronald Reagan came to power. You say that we saw explicit policies designed to shift responsibility away from health and welfare from the government towards private entities, philanthropic organizations, and corporations. So can you talk a little bit about how that affected the breast cancer movement and also to keep and hold corporations accountable?
Yeah, well, the breast cancer movement, or the corporatized version of the breast cancer movement, emerged in the mid to late 1980s, at the time Reagan was in power, and as you said, introducing these policies that were encouraging corporations to partner with the public and with nonprofit organizations to provide services that were previously paid for by the state. And in the case of breast cancer, I think it was about changing the mindset of the public to see this as a viable way to approach a disease by buying more stuff, basically, is what it amounted to, because we saw cause-related marketing as one of the key responses of corporations to that call.
And talk a little bit more about that. What was so interesting in the film is to see the images compare them to each other. So you have images from the 80s of women marching in the streets, saying these corporations need to be held accountable for the toxics in our environment and our bodies. And then comparing that to what we see at these walks where mm-hmm. women are dressed in pink and boas and pins, and you've got thousands of bottles of water and yogurt being handed out, and everybody's screaming and cheering and clapping. Talk about just the comparison between those images.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very stark. We went from a highly political movement that was concerned, as you say, with environmental toxics and with the social structures in our society that affected the incidence and mortality rates for breast cancer, to this very overly optimistic, commercialized approach that really at all costs tries to avoid dealing with the politics of breast cancer. And I think one of the really unfortunate things about that is that it misleads the public into thinking that we're actually making progress, whereas I think those images from the film really show that we might have in fact regressed in how we approach this disease.
And of course, the groups like Komen for the Cure, the Avon Walk, for example, would say, but look, everybody's talking about breast cancer now. There's pink everywhere. The NFL players are wearing it. We use the word breast on a regular basis. We just are talking about how people are uncomfortable using the word vagina in light of the senator from Michigan who used that word on the floor and was suspended for using the word. So what are your thoughts on that, Ravita, that this is now mainstream? People are actually talking about breast cancer because of all of these walks.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good thing. It's the more that we're talking about it, obviously, the better. But I think what has become, in my mind, you know, dangerous is that there's such a level of comfort, which means that there's less interrogation. There's less critical questioning of what exactly is this movement that we are all participating in. And the fact that we're even calling it a movement, you know, I was quite shocked in terms of doing my interviews with people like Nancy Brinker or with a representative from Avon or Carol Cohn, who's, you know, described as the mother of cause marketing, who described what they're doing as movements. Well, you know, my opinion is they're not movements. You know, these are well-rehearsed, very carefully packaged, planned PR events. You know, there's a formula for them. It's about bringing people together, and as Samantha says, you know, completely normalizing, softening the disease. There's a promise of a cure, so people feel that you have to come together in an atmosphere of hope and optimism. Aaron Reich refers to this as this relentless bright siding. I like Samantha's phrase even more, the tyranny of cheerfulness. And that this is a way to become political, and it's accepted, you know, when in fact it's not. And many of the women who were so active in the health movement in the 70s and 80s, who were encouraging women to network, to question doctors, to question the medical industry and mobilize, you know, would argue that this is part of, you know, what Judy Brady describes in the film as a quick fix culture. You feel that if you go online and donate a few cents somewhere, or you buy pink mushrooms or pink toilet paper, you've done your good deed for the day and you move on. It's not enough.
Samantha, what are your thoughts on that, the argument that all of these walks and all of the pink stuff is actually raising awareness?
My response to that question is awareness of what? I think that, well, I know that most people in North America are very aware that breast cancer exists. They're also aware of the kinds of screening technologies that are available to detect some cancers. What they're not aware of is the huge limitations of those technologies. And nor are they aware, as I've said before, of the extremely limited research agenda, the lack of progress we've made in treating the disease. And so the version of breast cancer that is presented to the public is extremely narrow, and it's not representative of the reality behind the, you know, the shiny pink perkiness of the culture.
And that is Samantha King. She is author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy, on which the new documentary film Pink Ribbons, Inc. is based. And Ravita Din is the producer of this new film. It opens this Friday in the Bay Area, and you can find out when it's coming to your area at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. What really comes up for you when you see a pink ribbon or a pink product? Or if a company like Kentucky Fried Chicken or Yoplait says, when you use this product, we'll donate 10 cents to breast cancer, to find a cure for breast cancer. What comes up for you when you see that ribbon? And if you've ever walked, do you think about where the money goes? Talk about the event itself. And do you think that this is doing a good job for or helping women who have breast cancer? And then what about those words prevention and cause? What do you think about the focus on cure, 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 but what about prevention? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Ravita, in your research, what did you find in terms of how much money is actually raised? Because so many organizations are raising money for research.
Yeah, the money question was a critical one for the film and probably one of the most challenging areas for us in terms of really figuring out not only how much is raised, but how it's spent, the latter being more difficult. But, you know, just larger context, the business in breast cancer is somewhere in the realm of $16 billion a year, you know, and this is radiation, chemotherapy, mammography, drugs, all of that. You have hundreds of organizations that are involved in breast cancer research. Some of the biggest in the U.S. are obviously, you know, Komen. You know, and Komen, since 1982 alone, has raised $1 billion in the name of breast cancer. You know, from their pink campaigns, just in 1 year, they've raised something like $300 million. You have someone like Avon that has raised over $525 million in 50 countries. You've got American Cancer Society, somewhere around $1.3 billion. So we're talking about billions of dollars being raised in the name of breast cancer. What we found was that while a lot of the money raised goes to looking specifically at biology of the disease, to individual types of treatment, some of the language that we found in a lot of the annual reports when we were trying to dissect where money goes was like outcomes and survivorship research, but we found that approximately 15% overall is spent on prevention and even less on looking at the environmental causes of breast cancer. We found on average around 5% is spent on environmental causes. So, you know, the question becomes, what are the outcomes when so much money is spent on research and there are so many players involved? Breast Cancer Action has obviously been doing so much work in this area, and they really helped us with trying to understand some of this. So Barbara Brenner talks about this in the film, and the fact that, you know, one of the weaknesses that with so many players, there's no coordination. So we have no idea what, you know, labs in different parts of the world are researching. And for all we know, they might actually be duplicating efforts over and over again.
Well, let's take a caller on this issue. Let's hear from Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm very upset about all this commercialism. I think it's absolutely directed in the wrong way. I stopped sponsoring walkers and sending money. And then, of course, the whole Susan, you know, Love fiasco months ago with Planned Parenthood. And I don't feel that this whole thing is being attacked in the right way. I feel that, at least from what I understand, there's very little money actually going to trying to find ways of preventing this. I mean, to me, prevention is the big thing. You know, cures, I mean, the cure seems to still be slash, burn, and poison. And, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are making an awful lot of money with this, so they probably don't want to either do anything for prevention or a cure because, well, prevention especially, because they're going to lose a lot of money. And I just hate it.
Well, thank you. Ravita, what came up in your interviews when you asked about prevention and why so little money is spent on prevention?
Not a lot, actually. It's a question that we asked, and I think that what we got was some fairly standard, fairly controlled responses that obviously prevention is important, but I would say that most participants that we spoke with about prevention said we need to do more research. The emphasis always seemed to come back to research. And what I found was that people were quite willing, you know, and this includes the oncologists that we interviewed, like Dr. Susan Love, who's renowned in the field of breast cancer, saying that, you know, this disease is so complex, it's so diverse, there are subtle connections to genetic variables, environmental variables. We still need to do the research. And that's why we are heavily investing in the research. So, not a clear answer as to why more money isn't being spent on prevention.
And what would you add to that, Samantha?
Ravina makes good points. I would also add that, you know, one of the responses you get is that it's difficult to do environmental research or preventative research, or that there isn't enough evidence to suggest that there are links between the toxins in our environment and cancer. But in fact, there's quite a bit of evidence. And if you follow the precautionary principle of first do no harm, we could make a huge difference, I think, to the health status of millions of people if we just have more regulation of the kinds of toxins that we release into our environment. And the film does a great job. One of my favorite pieces is the interview that the filmmakers did with a working group in Windsor, Ontario, who are looking at women who've worked in the plastics industry and their high rates of breast cancer. And if we just think about how changing the working conditions of people has the potential to affect thousands of people at the preventative stage, rather than focusing on a cure for relatively small numbers of people.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call. Mm-hmm. And let's hear from one more caller before we go to break. Let's go to Marla in San Francisco. Hi, Marla. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. The point that I wanted to make was that I was diagnosed at 32, had a bilateral mastectomy, and really didn't know what I needed to do after I went through my treatment. And I did the walks for about a year, and then I realized it served absolutely no purpose for me. It made me feel more tokenized based on the fact that I was a young person at the time. And Pink Ribbons, Inc. is phenomenal because it really raises the awareness that there's so much more than what you see. And right now, for me personally, I serve on Breast Cancer Action's board because I so much believe in the fact that people need to, the awareness only gets you so far, and ignorance doesn't get you far at all. It's people, you know, assume pink is the way to go because that's what they see, and there's really a lot more than what's on the surface.
Well, and Marla, Breast Cancer Action has done so much work behind the Think Before You Pink campaign. I mean, they put pressure on everyone from Kentucky Fried Chicken to American Express, which in 2002 had a campaign in the fight against breast cancer, Every Dollar Counts. For every purchase made between September and December with participating stores, the company would give one penny per purchase.
Right.
And Breast Cancer Action exposed that if you spend $1,000, it's a penny, or a dollar, it's a penny. And then they ended the campaign. So what are your thoughts about where this goes from here? And is the goal to reach the women who go to the walks to have a dialogue about what the walks actually do? Because, you know, in Ravita's film, I've seen the walks in San Francisco. I've never participated, but like the walks in Washington, D.C., I mean, you've got, it's fairly diverse. You have a lot of, it's mostly white women, but you have a lot of black women also marching, people crying, people putting their fists in the air who've survived. I mean, how do you start a dialogue with those women?
That's a huge question. And
well, you know what? Hold on. Why don't you spend a minute thinking about it? We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Hello, this is Chuck Finney of Your Legal Rights. We're having a Call a Lawyer night this Wednesday evening starting at 7. If you have legal questions for attorneys off the air, please call 1-800-525-9917. On the air, on Your Legal Rights, the topic will be landlord-tenant laws and issues. My guests will be landlord-tenant attorneys James Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 for Call a Lawyer night and Your Legal Rights here at 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, we will talk about Amazon.com's agenda, the largest internet retailer transforming business in a huge way. So we will talk about how the company allows and offers so many discounts. We'll also talk about how they've used their political power to avoid sales taxes and other regulations. If you're an Amazon shopper, we'd love to hear from you. And we'll also ask, where is Amazon going next? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Ravita Din. She's producer of the new documentary, Pink Ribbons, Inc. And it asks a number of very important questions. When you take a look at all of the walks, the runs, the rows for the cure, and then all of the pink ribbon products, the billions of dollars that have been raised, where does this money go? And what is this actually doing to decrease breast cancer rates? In the 40s, a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer was 1 in 22. Today, it is 1 in 8. So how are these women being helped by the billions raised? The film opens this Friday in the Bay Area. You can find out when it comes to your town at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Samantha King, associate professor in the School of Kinesiology and Health Studies in the Cultural Studies Program at Queen's University in Canada. She's author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy, on which the film is based. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've ever walked, if you've gone to one of the walks for the cure, if you've bought a pink ribbon. Actually, I was at the Stanford Cancer Clinic just a couple of months ago, and they were handing out pink ribbons to the clients that come in. So if you've ever received a pink ribbon or bought a pink ribbon, where does the money go? And what really comes up for you when you see pink? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have breast cancer or had breast cancer, do you think that the pink ribbon campaigns are actually helping you and the women that you know, because we are all affected by this? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And Marla, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Okay, great. So why don't you talk a little bit about just the conversations you'd like to have between maybe someone like yourself who's not really in favor of the pink walks, and then the people who spend a year raising money for the pink walks.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would say to that, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak a little further on this, what I would want to say to people is just to really think, really just that, think before you pink. BCA's campaign is very clear in letting people understand that, what I said earlier, there's so much more than what you see on the surface. For example, with Susan B. Komen, we did a campaign called the Promise Me campaign, just questioning what toxins, or rather, what was the composition of the perfume that they were selling, where X amount of the proceeds would actually supposedly go to cancer research. So what I would do is just really have conversations like that with people, just really look beyond the surface to see where your money is going. Kentucky Fried Chicken had a campaign where supposedly X amount of money would go towards research. So what BCA did was really talk about what the cluck, where exactly is that money going to? So the conversations I would have with people is just look a lot more than what you see what's on the surface. Every year in October, Facebook has a campaign where women say what color their bra is. And personally, my question to that is, I don't know, the color of your bra, what impact is that going to have on breast cancer awareness and or looking for a cure?
All right.
So, again, I would just ask the very simple questions, which is a way to pull people in to get them to examine things further.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Marla. That's Marla calling in. She's on the board of Breast Cancer Action in San Francisco. And Samantha, how would you address that question? I'm sure you've spoken to a lot of women who put so much time and effort into raising money for the walks.
Absolutely. And I think that the film actually does a really good job of representing these women and their good intentions in a very sensitive and complex way. And that's what I try to do too when I talk to people, to recognize that the work and the effort they've put in to their fundraising, but also to push them a little bit about where that money goes and whether it is being effectively spent. And I get the sense from talking to people that in general, there's a huge lack of awareness about that, both among individuals, but also among corporations. It's incredible the numbers of companies I've talked to, and they have no idea where their money's going. Once they sign that agreement with the nonprofit, and they hand it over, and you know, it just sort of disappears into the ether, and there's very little accountability.
Do we still have as many companies starting these relationships? Because there has been a lot of outrage over the Yoplait with the bovine growth hormone, and then you've got all the car manufacturers and the Kentucky Fried Chicken outrage. I mean, are companies still doing this?
Well, this is a very interesting phenomenon to me. Usually companies try and distinguish themselves from their competitors by doing something different or unique. But with breast cancer, it really seems like the opposite logic is in operation. So it's hard to find a large corporation that doesn't have a breast cancer cause. And certainly cause-related marketing for breast cancer, at least until very recently, hasn't shown any sign of stopping. And in fact, we've seen a sort of continued diversification of the kinds of brands and products that get attached to breast cancer, you know, handguns and oil rigs and gasoline trucks and these kinds of things. I think in terms of the Komen debacle earlier this year, it's a bit too soon to see how that might shift the terrain. I certainly think the public has gone through a process of education, and I do hope that that results in some broader changes in terms of how we approach the disease.
The other interesting thing is in the film, Samantha, you talk about the globalization of breast cancer research and how this is now being sold to other countries. So you've got WOX, for example, in Egypt, and a number of corporate multinationals are now getting on board with Pink products.
Yeah, so like all good global marketing, once you've sort of saturated your own market, you look for new markets overseas. And as Barbara Brenner says in the film, we're very good at this, at sending the worst of our stuff overseas. And this approach to breast cancer, this kind of breast cancer awareness, cause-related marketing, costly fundraising walks and runs, that is now what corporations are taking overseas. And interestingly enough, as you mentioned, to places of great strategic interest like the Middle East, where breast cancer is being used as a form of soft power alongside military intervention to win the hearts and minds of Middle Easterners, which, as I say in the film, I think is a very insidious use of breast cancer awareness.
Yeah, it was amazing to see a video of Laura Bush sitting with women in, I believe it was in Saudi Arabia? Completely covered in black chadors with a pink outline, so you couldn't even see their faces. I mean, they were completely covered, but there was a pink outline on the black.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's go next to Kelly in Alameda. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My comment is I was diagnosed with breast cancer and went through treatment starting in 2004, and it's so frightening. So I really jumped on board her. Very enthusiastic about the walks and the causes. And then one day I just stopped and said, there is no cure. Our focus should be on prevention and coaching women and young girls on how to prevent it. And then the treatment, because I went through an excellent treatment program and I'm better than ever. And so the whole thing of cure, that really, really bothers me. And that's my comment for today.
All right. Well, thank you, Kelly. And we'll take a few more calls and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Rachel in Salinas. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. You know, I had three sisters and they all died of cancer. And and one in 1982, one in 2001, and one just last year. And I tell you one thing, that from 82 until last year, they went through the same exact problems. They spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on private doctors and private acute-like, and nothing happened. And when you say that 22% were one of 22, or 22 out of one that were cured, and now it's 8 out of 1, heck, you know, I know I'm going to die from the same thing. And I want to know, you know, we have a friend that is a professor in one of the universities. She's a cancer researcher. All I know is that she's going from one place in the world to the other and spending thousands of dollars on hotels. And I don't know what she does, because I know her for the last 30 years and still nothing happened. She can't tell me how this thing. I'm so angry that I'm sorry, I can't really.
Well, it's okay, Rachel. Thank you for calling. And just so I get the numbers correct, in the 1940s, a woman's lifetime risk of breast cancer was 1 in 22. Today, it is 1 in 8. And just to put it another way, around the world, every 23 seconds, someone is diagnosed with breast cancer, and every 69 seconds, someone dies. And Rachel brings up an interesting point about the friend that's traveling around. Can you talk a little bit, Ravita, about just the language that is used? I mean, Barbara Brenner and Barbara Ehrenreich both pointed out that the militancy has been lost. And so now you go into the streets and you use the word hope. You know, if you think positively, you will survive this. It's all about very positive and affirming language. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, it's not surprising that a lot of the campaigns are trying to appeal to the feminine and nurturing nature of women. You know, women are encouraged to be good and be smiling and happy all the time. And, you know, unfortunately, we still live in a culture that doesn't accept anger, you know, and women have the right to be very angry about this. This is how change happens. So what was interesting to me, even my own personal and professional interest in terms of starting work in this documentary, you know, I even found myself thinking, you know, should I really be questioning this? You know, I live in Canada, there's privilege, I have access to treatment, and surely it's a result of all of this great effort and work that's been done. There are a lot of committed people. And what I found was, you know, and I needed to read the books like Samantha King has written and Ehrenreich and going back to Audre Lorde's book, Cancer Journals, to remind myself that, you know, we can never stop interrogating and ask those questions. And yes, I have a right to be angry and demand some answers. But it showed to me, you know, as somebody who is not afraid to dive into these important political questions, that even my own reluctance show just how powerful the message has been that's been sold to us, that it's only in, you know, in a context of optimism and hope that we're going to see an end to this. And in fact, you know, as Barbara Ehrenreich writes, when she expresses anger, people are telling her to go seek therapy, you know, that surely you don't have a right to feel this. But in fact, we know that great change comes about when actually women say, you know, no, we've had enough. This isn't acceptable. And just, you know, speaking to the last caller who talked about being angry, you know, yeah, we absolutely have a right to be angry, and emotional, and be sad, you know, and grieve. Those are all very, very legitimate emotions to have around what's still a very frightening disease.
And this brings up some questions also, Samantha, about capitalism, because you now have women taking part in the public sphere, you know, not raising their fists and saying, DuPont, you must be held responsible for the pollution that you put into the air and the in our bodies. But they do it in a very non-confrontational way. So can you talk a little bit about that and what your research has really brought out for you in terms of what this means about where we are right now?
You know, one of the broader points of my book is that we've really, the culture of what it means to be a good citizenship has quite dramatically changed over the last three decades. So in the current moment, to be a good citizen is to consume appropriately and to channel your political energies, your civic energies through consumption, and there's very little room outside of that. And anger and protest and activism have been thoroughly delegitimated in in our culture. And one of the things that the implications of that for breast cancer is that we're in a situation where we think that what is a medical and a social problem is best responded to by shopping. And I don't think that any social problems are going to be solved through the realm of consumption. We actually have to think sort of outside and beyond capitalist approaches to these issues.
And we have an email from Robert who says, and the obvious thing here is that we need real national health care.
Yes, and that's certainly an issue that is entirely erased from the dominant culture of breast cancer, with, you know, executives on the Komen Foundation board leading campaigns against extending healthcare benefits to broader members of the public, and the effect of that is huge discrepancies in mortality rates, for instance, even here in Canada, actually, between the rich and the poor, and in breast cancer, and of course lots of other diseases too.
That is Samantha King. She is author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy. We're also joined by Ravita Din. She's producer of the documentary Pink Ribbons, Inc. It opens in the Bay Area, throughout the Bay Area, this Friday, and you can find out when it's coming to your area at yourcallradio.org. And we have just under 10 minutes left. We have one line open. If you'd like to join us to talk about what comes up when you see pink or pink ribbon, if you have cancer or you're a cancer survivor, we'd love to hear from you. And if you've taken part in one of the walks, what are your thoughts about the questions this film raises about where the money goes? And does this stuff do any good at the end of the day? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Terry in San Francisco. Hi, Terry. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I have a couple of different reasons to be involved in the discussion. The first is that I got breast cancer when I was 31, and that was 7 years ago now. And I went through treatment at Stanford and got amazingly, you know, amazing great doctors and all female staff. And it was a really positive experience to be there and get my treatment. But obviously having the disease was really horrible at such a young age. So it sort of pushed me into the forefront of the young women's movement, because the time I got sick, there weren't that many young women to talk to. One of the things that I also am a fine art photographer, and at the time I decided to shoot a self-portrait series of myself as I went through treatment, because I felt like the one thing that I didn't find out there when I'm looking were sort of honest, real pictures of women going through treatment that weren't glorified, I guess you could say. I've been really lucky in the past 2 years. I've put the series out there and it's been doing really well, and I've won a lot of awards and gotten it shown, but ironically, it really does best in European and Latin American countries. I'm naked from the waist up, and our culture seems to have a problem with nakedness when it's not associated with sexuality. All of that said, I think that I also went to Washington, D.C. as a representative for the American Cancer Society, something they do called Cancer on the Hill. And I went right after I got out of chemotherapy. I was still bald when I showed up in Washington, D.C. So I feel really tied to the whole pink ribbon aspect as well. And I read a really amazing article in Mary Claire last October in Breast Cancer Month, and they did an entire, like, six-page article called The Business of Breast Cancer. And it was really interesting because they basically outlined everything that you guys have been talking about. And at the end, they said, if you do want to donate, this is a list of the five places that actually do good with the donation.
Uh-huh. Well, we got a call about that, so we'll definitely link to that. And I'd love to get your comments on that. We have a few questions from listeners about this, Samantha. If you do want to help and you care about prevention and causes, what's the best approach?
Well, the best approach, I think, is to find out as much as you can about the organizations you want to give to. And I suggest people give directly to organizations whose work they support, rather than filtering their money through large corporations or through fundraising walks and runs, so that they really know that they're getting maximum benefit for their dollar. If people are worried about prevention and concerned about prevention, organizations like Breast Cancer Action do amazing work. And I really don't think we would be having the kinds of conversations we're having if it wasn't for the work that they do.
And do you have anything to add, Ravita?
I would just say that I totally agree with Samantha. It means hard work, you know? And I think that if people really want societal change, it means it's not good enough to just go and shop. You have to think about whether you actually want to change women's experience or if you actually want a complete transformation in women's status, you know? And if we want the latter, it means you have to figure out where your hard-earned dollars are going. And you have to demand that of the organizations who are asking you for your money and ask those questions. You know, how much money will you raise? Where will it go? Where will it be spent? How are those decisions made? Who sits on your boards? You know, who are the boards of directors? People, you know, one of the things that I found the most shocking when we began the research was the origin of October, Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Its origins lie with a pharmaceutical company, which is now AstraZeneca. You know, people need to know that and be aware of where they want to give their money.
Right. And Zeneca is the American arm of the largest chemical company in the world. And the film elaborates and goes into detail about this and also the history of the breast cancer ribbon. I love the story behind this. We might have some time to talk about that, but I just want to get through a few calls and emails because we're getting a lot. A number of listeners have written in to ask you both to talk about all of the other walks that take place, not just focusing on breast cancer. So Jody writes, for 20 years, I volunteered at and supported AIDS Walk San Francisco. I'm wondering now what portion of funds raised in that event go to supporting the event itself. Is it bad as the breast cancer walks? And we have another listener who says, do you know if these insights can be translated to other illnesses like other cancers, disabilities? I see posters all the time for bike rides, fundraisers for so many kinds of diseases. What should we know about those? My understanding is that they're not all created equal and some actually do what they say they're doing. Did you look into this, Ravita?
No, actually, I didn't go into a great detail, but certainly there were parallels that were raised all the time. I think Samantha could be better person to answer that because she and I had talked a little bit about AIDS. And of course, in her book, she does talk about the beginnings of the shift from politics to charity, you know, and beginning how that all started with getting asking people to become active and get fit. So I don't know, Samantha, if you can comment on that.
Sure. I mean, I think it's hard to generalize about. I wouldn't want to say, you know, this walk is better than that walk without knowing a bit more about them. But in general, fundraising runs and walks are not efficient ways to raise money. Most nonprofits use them as a way to build their brand identity, to get their message out to the public. Their major income tends to come from private donations. So I think that's an important thing to bear in mind. In terms of other disease constituencies using this model, yes. And one of the things that worries me is in the wake of the troubles at the Komen Foundation, that will just take our money and this model to other diseases and replicate it. And then the problem will actually grow rather than shrink. And it's certainly true. At the end of my book, I talk a little bit about the prostate cancer movement and how they have tried very explicitly to model themselves on the breast cancer movement. And we see the same thing with heart disease with the Little Red Dress campaign. And as Ravita said, what I think we really need to be doing is questioning whether raising money is or should be the primary way to approach a problem. Most revolutions don't come about through fundraising, and I think we have to keep that at the forefront of our mind if we want to see the world change.
All right, well, we have time for just a few more callers. Just quickly, let's go to Steve in the Presidio. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I'm curious about if there have been any parallel studies in petroleum-based chemicals such as plastics post-World War II, because it seems like all our food is encased in plastics.
Right.
And I'm wondering about leaching and a disturbance in the endocrine systems and so forth.
Yes. Well, you do raise this question, Ravita, in the film,
yeah.
And you bring on doctors to address this.
Yeah, there is a lot of work that has been done particularly with respect to the plastics industry. And we do touch on it in the film. Samantha mentioned it earlier with a focus group that has worked primarily with in car manufacturing. There is a lot of work that's done around this area, you know, including vehicle exhaust and gasoline fumes, which have been linked to increased incidences of breast cancer for both women and men. You know, Sandra Steingraber, in her book Living Downstream, writes that, you know, all of us who were born before 2010 entered into a world under the protection of an environmental law that's now understood to be ineffective. You know, we've got, she writes, more than 80,000 or so chemicals circulating in our environment, and only 2% of them have been thoroughly tested for toxicity. It was unfortunate we couldn't go into more detail with this in the film, but there was some very interesting debates happening with the Safe Chemicals Act in the U.S.
Right.
and the conversations with the Environmental Protection Agency. And what I was reading was that, you know, what we have had to date as legislation that's supposed to protect our health has been largely ineffective. So, yes, there is a lot of strong evidence out there about the need to look at relationship between environmental factors.
I will add this to our show list, and I'm sorry to cut you off. We have about 15 seconds left. Samantha, what are you hoping comes from this film?
That we change the conversation about breast cancer in ways that will lead to change rather than the business as usual approach that we've been working with for the last couple of decades.
Samantha King is author of Pink Ribbons, Inc., Breast Cancer and the Politics of Philanthropy, and Ravita Din is producer of the documentary by the same name, Pink Ribbons, Inc., and it opens in the Bay Area this Friday. You can find out when it comes to your area at yourcallradio.org. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is Amazon's agenda? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about how the largest internet retailer is transforming business. Amazon's model of deep discounts has allowed it to become the dominant book retailer. Are you an Amazon shopper? Join us at 10 or post a comment to yourcallradio.org. We'll also discuss how Amazon has used its political power to avoid sales taxes and other regulations. Where is Amazon headed next? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.